say that our final comprehensive reparations plan, which will be in our final report due next summer, those recommendations must comport with international human rights law standards. And under international law, there are 5 forms of reparations.
And talk about the record, the precedent-setting nature of this report in the entire country, not just California.
Well, yes, you know, as so goes California, so goes the nation. That's for many different progressive issues that have originated in California. And, you know, reparations for African Americans or American freemen in particular are one of those, you know, progressive ideas that we hope sets a precedent not only for other states, but of course for the federal government, because reparations for the African American community, for the institution of slavery, the transatlantic slave trade in the afterlife, is first and foremost a federal responsibility. And that's why we have in our preliminary recommendations to transmit this historic report to the Biden administration, which they've acknowledged the day that it was released, in hopes that they create a commission on the federal level for African Americans or American freemen specifically.
Well, Camila Moore, we want to thank you for being with us, attorney, chairperson of the California Reparations Task Force. We'll link to your 500-page precedent-setting reparations report. That does it for our show. Again, on Thursday, Democracy Now! Will be live streaming this historic January 6th insurrection hearing, the House committee, the first of the series of hearings. We'll be live streaming at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Mary Conlon, Juan Carlos Davila. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 7th Annual Vanport Mosaic Festival, on now through Tuesday, June 7th in Portland. The Vanport Mosaic is back with its annual Memory Activism Festival to, quote, remember, repair, reclaim, and reimagine our collective story. The festival will center on the 80th anniversary of the building of Vanport, once Oregon's second largest city and the largest World War II federal housing project in the United States. Highlights include Vanport the Musical and a panel discussion on Portland's past, present, and future of affordable housing. Again, that's the 7th annual Vanport Mosaic Festival, on now through Tuesday, June 7th in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Stand by me. Stand by me.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-charge bookkeeper. Do you have accounting and administrative experience? Do you enjoy working in a highly collaborative team environment? Are you looking for a workplace with a mission? Or do you know someone who is? Go to kboo.fm to learn more about the essential functions of the full-charge bookkeeper and the qualifications we are looking for. To apply, please email your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org by Sunday, June 12th at midnight. You can also apply by mailing your resume and cover letter to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. KBOO's financial health is our focus. Help us foster it.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, nurses reach a tentative contract agreement with Providence St. Vincent in Portland, A Proud Boys leader and four other members are charged with seditious conspiracy in a January 6th case, and CDC data shows the U.S. has wasted over 82 million vaccine doses. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 6th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Nurses at Providence St. Vincent Medical Center have reached a tentative contract agreement with the hospital, avoiding a potential strike. This comes after nearly 8 months of negotiations between the hospital and the nurses. Providence St. Vincent Medical Center and the Oregon Nurses Association labor negotiation teams announced Saturday that they reached a tentative agreement, which covers almost 1,600 registered nurses. The contract includes new COVID-19 safety standards, higher wages, improved nurse staffing, and more patient safety standards. The Oregon Nurses Association says the nurses will vote on the new contract soon. Nurses at Providence Milwaukee, Willamette Falls, and Hood River hospitals will continue bargaining. Nurses at all three of those hospitals have voted to authorize strikes. More bargaining sessions are scheduled in the coming weeks. A group of Oregon nonprofits is asking the Biden administration to invest $100 million to address white supremacy in the state. They're asking the administration to invest in two areas: federal agencies that can increase surveillance and prosecutions, as well as community-based organizations that can boost social and health services. The nonprofits provide service to communities of color. In a joint letter addressed to the president, they say Oregon is susceptible to domestic terror attacks against people of color. Tony DeFalco is the executive director of the Latino Network, one of the organizations responsible for the letter. DeFalco said the move was prompted by this year's deadly mass shooting at a grocery store in Buffalo, New York. In Buffalo, a white gunman killed 10 black people in an attack the president called hate-filled domestic terrorism and a racially motivated hate crime. DeFalco said, quote, "These recent events have communities of color really feeling on edge. This level of volatility and vulnerability is urgent and demands action from our federal government," end quote. The letter added, quote, "We need investment, we need partnership, and we need our federal government to treat the white supremacist insurgency targeting communities for what it is, an existential threat to our way of life." Oregon is one of only 16 states that does not have a law defining and outlawing domestic terrorism and violent extremism. Cases are usually handled by the federal government, but the report recommends Oregon lawmakers come up with their own state laws. The letter notes that Oregon ranked 6th in the nation in the number of violent extremist attacks between 2011 and 2020, according to an advisory report by the Oregon Secretary of State's office. That report, which was published in March, suggested new laws and policies that could help the state prevent extremist attacks. Workers in the public sector are finding it easier to get their student debt erased after the Biden administration overhauled the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program last year. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
After changes to streamline the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, more workers are getting their student debt erased. The U.S. Education Department program forgives student loans for public sector employees after 10 years of consistent payments. Annalise Simon is a psychiatric social worker at Western State Hospital and member of the Washington Federation of State Employees. She'd racked up more than $50,000 in debt. She says she used the revamped program and worked with the Education Department website.
I used their little tool that typed everything in and then sent it to our HR department and then faxed it over to the student loan folks. And surprise, surprise, a few weeks later, my loan was forgiven.
Since overhauling the program in October, more than 127,000 people have qualified for the program, according to the federal data. However, the waiver making it easier to qualify is only in place until October 31st. Simon says her application was probably simplified because she'd had the same employer since she graduated. But she says applying is worth the time, especially when you do the math.
I maybe spent a total of an hour on this, and for an hour, I got $11,000 forgiven. I thought that was time well spent.
Simon says this is an important program that public service employees deserve, noting they're paid less than the private sector, and it's a good incentive to bring workers into public work.
Public servants, people who work with the public, people who do the jobs that most people would not want to do, are important and run this country.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio and four other Proud Boy members have been indicted by a federal grand jury on new seditious conspiracy charges related to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Tarrio faces a superseding indictment along with Ethan Nordine, Joseph Biggs, Zach Real, and Dominic Pozzola. Tarrio was previously charged in a conspiracy case. The new seditious conspiracy charges allege that Tarrio was aware of discussions around a plan to storm the Capitol on January 6th and was involved in discussions about occupying buildings, including Capitol Complex buildings. Members of the right-wing Oath Keepers organization were previously indicted on seditious conspiracy charges, but this marks the first time the charges have been brought against members of the Proud Boys. The superseding indictment notes that Tarrio and Stuart Rhodes, the former head of the Oath Keepers, met in an underground garage on January 5th. The indictment alleges that Proud Boy members further discussed storming the Capitol in an online chat. The new charges show that prosecutors are pulling together a wider picture of organization within the far-right extremist groups. At the same time, the deepening criminal investigation has exposed hints of coordination among groups, even as the FBI and Justice Department are expanding their probe into the ranks of former President Donald Trump's political orbit. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack is expected to shine a spotlight on such connections in public hearings beginning Thursday. The judge overseeing the remaining case of two former Minneapolis police officers charged in George Floyd's killing ordered Monday that the trial be delayed until January to improve prospects for a fair trial. The former officers, Totao and J. Alexander Kang, had been due to go on trial next Monday on charges of aiding and abetting second-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter in the May 2020 death of Floyd. Hennepin County Judge Peter Cahill ordered that the trial be delayed until January 5, 2023. Cahill denied a defense motion for a change of venue due to the extensive pretrial publicity surrounding the case, but he said media reports and recent events surrounding connected cases have created a reasonable likelihood of an unfair trial if it were to begin next week. Cahill cited the May 18th guilty plea by Tao and Kang's co-defendant, former officer Thomas Lane. He also cited the convictions of Tao, Kang, and Lane on federal civil rights charges in a separate trial in federal court in February. The judge says those two events and the publicity surrounding them are significant enough to make it difficult for jurors to presume innocence. Cahill also presided over last year's trial of former officer Derek Chauvin, which ended in a conviction for second-degree murder and a 22-and-a-half-year sentence for Chauvin. Chauvin kneeled on Floyd's neck for 10 minutes while Floyd pleaded for his life, ultimately killing him. The killing sparked worldwide protests and a national reckoning on racial injustice. Chauvin has been in prison since his conviction on the state murder charge, while Tao, Kang, and Lane remained free on bail pending their federal sentencings. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, whose office is prosecuting the case, said in a statement, quote, "It's unfortunate for the victims, the witnesses, and community that the opportunity to seek justice has been delayed. The state was ready for trial next week and will be ready next January." June is National Rivers Month. The River Democracy Act in Congress could add greater federal protections to 4,700 miles of river in Oregon. Eric Tegedoff has more.
June is National Rivers Month, and a proposal in Congress would protect more of Oregon's rivers. Currently, about 2% of Oregon's 110,000 miles of river are protected under the federal Wild and Scenic River Act. The River Democracy Act would add wild and scenic protections to 4,700 miles. Kate Samsel is co-owner of Humble Heron Fly Fishing and Fine Art, which operates on the Rogue River. She says safeguarding more rivers in the state is important for future generations.
The idea is to be able to catch these things ahead of time, put in these protections ahead of time, versus caught with our tail between the legs and go, oh man, there's a huge issue. If we would have seen the trend, we would have been on top of the ball.
The River Democracy Act has received pushback from Republicans in Oregon. They say it could hamper Timber County's ability to reduce forest fuels, which increases the risk of fire hazards. Wild and scenic designation does not impact private property or traditional uses of the land like fishing and hunting. Samsel says rivers are a crucial part of the outdoor recreation economy in Oregon, which generates more than $15 billion in consumer spending. She says communities on the Rogue River, 36 miles of which is protected as wild and scenic, get that.
The main vein, that Rogue River, is running right through numerous communities. Without the river, those communities would suffer hugely.
The Oregon waterways included in the River Democracy Act were chosen from more than 15,000 suggestions sent to Senator Ron Wyden's office. Samsel says there's an easy and fun way to help folks understand their importance.
Start by going out and playing at your local river and building a connection. And that start right there, I hope that you'll understand why we're needing to protect these rivers.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The United States has discarded more than 82 million COVID vaccine doses from December 2020 through mid-May of this year. According to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the 82.1 million vaccines represent just over 11% of the doses the federal government has distributed. Two retail pharmacy chains, CVS and Walmart, were responsible for over a quarter of the doses thrown away in the U.S. in that time period. This is in part due to the sheer volume of vaccines that they handled. Five other pharmacies or dialysis centers, Health Mart, DaVita, Rite Aid, Publix, and Costco, wasted fewer overall doses but a higher share. Those companies wasted more than a quarter of the vaccine doses they received, well above the national average. Two states also discarded more than a quarter of their doses, Oklahoma, which tossed 28% of nearly 4 million doses that it received, and Alaska, which threw away almost 27% of its 1 million doses. The overall amount of waste is in line with World Health Organization estimates for large vaccination campaigns. However, public health experts say the waste is still alarming at a time when less than half of fully vaccinated Americans have a booster shot and when other countries continue to struggle with vaccine supply. The millions of wasted vaccine doses include some that expired on pharmacy shelves before they could be used, others that were spoiled by the thousands when power went out or freezers broke, and some that were tossed at the end of the day when no one wanted the last few doses in an open vial. Unlike most other immunizations in the U.S., the coronavirus vaccines come in multi-dose vials, which means all the doses must be used within the hours once the vials are opened or they have to be discarded. Some pharmacies, including CVS and Rite Aid, says their priority has been offering the vaccine on demand. If getting a shot into an arm means opening a new vial and wasting the unused doses, that's a trade-off they say they're willing to make. CVS wasted nearly 11.8 million doses, or about 13% of the 89 million it received. Walgreens, one of the nation's largest pharmacy chains, wasted 8.3 million doses, or about 10% of the nearly 79 million it received. Experts say the challenge of getting shots into arms and avoiding waste has become especially difficult as demand wanes for the vaccines. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with comedian Hannah Gadsby, following that up with Noise Filter. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, we'll hear Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Let's Talk About Race. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 52 degrees. Tomorrow, again, will be partly cloudy with a high of 78. Today in history, in 1944, Supreme Allied Commander General Dwight D. Eisenhower gives the go-ahead for the largest amphibious military operation in history, Operation Overlord, the Allied invasion of northern France at Normandy's coast, commonly known as D-Day. The quote of the day is from civil rights activist and retired nurse aide Claudette Colvin, who said, quote, "I always tell young people to hold on to their dreams, and sometimes you have to stand up for what you think is right, even if you have to stand alone." Consumer and health groups are praising a move by the feds to favor fiber optic technology over wireless as the country expands broadband with billions from the infrastructure bill. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
Groups that promote the responsible deployment of technology are celebrating the Biden administration's new $42.5 billion Broadband Equity Access and Development Program because it favors fiber optic technology over broadband communications technologies such as cable, satellite, DSL, and wireless. Gary Bolton with the Fiber Broadband Association says fiber optic connections are faster, more reliable, and can adapt easily to future technological advances.
You'd be able to do things like smart grid modernization, public safety, and then even advanced services like 5G. So having this near limitless capacity is going to really close the digital divide once and for all.
The National Telecommunications and Information Administration aims to ensure that all communities, including underserved, low-income rural areas, have high-speed broadband so they don't get left behind in the digital economy. The funding for the broadband rollout comes from the bipartisan infrastructure law. Americans for Responsible Technology President Doug Wood says health groups favor fiber broadband over wireless because wireless cell towers emit radio frequency radiation. And a 2018 study from the National Institutes of Health linked RF radiation to cancer in lab animals.
We're beginning to understand that it has biological impacts, even at levels far below what the government considers safe. So it seems like an unwise decision to start installing wireless antennas and wireless broadband in communities across the country.
Proponents of wireless technology say their products are safe. On their blog, the wireless company Ceragon argues that fixed wireless solutions are dependable, have higher bandwidth, and are faster and cheaper to deploy and maintain. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Mayors discuss gun violence and mental health in the wake of more mass shootings. Donald Trump's former advisor lashes out at the January 6th committee, and the 2022 primary season resumes after a two-week hiatus. With more on these stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Our nation is reeling from not just the recent mass shootings in Buffalo and Uvalde, but we had just two. It's just unconscionable. Our nation is hurting. Our children are hurting.
That's Miami Mayor Francis Juarez commenting on shootings since Uvalde that left at least six dead in Pennsylvania, South Carolina, and Tennessee. He spoke at the U.S. Conference of Mayors annual meeting, where Vice President Kamala Harris called for tougher gun laws.
No 86-year-old should fear for her safety to go to the grocery store. No 9-year-old should be afraid to go to school. And no 18-year-old should be able to buy a weapon of war.
A package of gun control bills is expected to reach the House floor this week. Bipartisan Senate negotiations are focusing on reforming gun rules and investing in mental health. Sunday, U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy told the mayors there is a medical and moral obligation to face what he called a crisis in the people's mental health.
It doesn't just affect how they feel. It affects their physical health. It affects productivity in the workplace, how kids perform in school. It affects also civic engagement and people's participation in communities. And it affects our ability to dialogue with one another.
Murthy called for increased access to treatment and more investments in prevention. The House Select Committee is gearing up for its first public hearing set for primetime Thursday. Democrat Adam Schiff of California hinted more details will come out about the run-up to the U.S. Capitol attack on January 6, 2021. Meanwhile, while pleading not guilty to two counts of contempt of Congress, former Trump advisor Peter Navarro accused the committee of conspiring against him.
Instead of calling me and say, hey, we need you down at court, we've got a warrant for you, I would have gladly come. What did they do? They intercepted me getting on the plane. And then they put me in handcuffs, they bring me here, they put me in leg irons, they stick me in a cell.
Navarro is accused of ignoring a subpoena. In election news, hedge fund manager David McCormick conceded the Pennsylvania Republican Senate nomination to TV doctor Mehmet Oz. The celebrity and patent medicine pitchman was leading a recount by fewer than 1,000 votes. The 2022 midterms continue tomorrow with primaries in California, Iowa, Mississippi, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, and South Dakota. Maine holds its primary on the 14th, and Governor Janet Mills says they are on heightened alert to keep their election safe.
From combating misinformation to advancing new cybersecurity protocols, voters must be able to make informed decisions and have faith in the integrity of the voting process. Our very democracy is at stake.
In an ABC News poll, voters say the top three most important issues for them now are the president's handling of the economy, inflation, and high gas prices. In all three areas, a majority disapproved of Biden's performance. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eight trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A large data center could be built near Polson, Montana in the coming years. A candlelight vigil is planned Monday night in front of the White Mountain Apache Police Department in Arizona, and the Cherokee Nation and the U.S. Mint are hosting a public event Monday to celebrate the release of the Wilma Mankiller Quarter. With those stories and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A large data center could be built near Polson, Montana in the coming years. As Aaron Bolton reports, the proposal was pitched during a technology summit last week.
Entrepreneur Kevin O'Leary, also known as Mr. Wonderful on the TV show Shark Tank, announced at the summit held in Bozeman, his investment firm is working with the Bitcoin mining company BitZero and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes to potentially build the data center.
The demand for these centers is insatiable all around the world. And the states that have figured this out, that have good policy, have wind, have hydro, have solar. This is the future.
O'Leary said the center could provide services to Bitcoin miners and data storage for other web-based services. Most of the power to the facility would come from the Salish Kootenai Dam, south of Polson on the Flathead Reservation. CSKT Tribal Council Secretary Martin Charlo says the tribes are interested in the jobs the center could provide for locals.
Our tribes have always been a people of vision, and I believe that Kevin and Mr. Daines and Governor Gianforte and Akbar are all bringing this great vision to us.
While the tribes say they haven't committed to the project, they'll continue looking into the data center to see if it's a viable business opportunity. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
A candlelight vigil is planned Monday night in front of the White Mountain Apache Police Department in Arizona for fallen officer Adrian Lopez, who was killed during an officer-involved shooting last week on the Fort Apache Reservation. According to police, Lopez was conducting a traffic stop Thursday night when an altercation occurred between the officer and the person operating the vehicle. Lopez was fatally shot during the altercation. The suspect then took his police vehicle and fled the scene. The suspect was pursued by police and was involved in a gun battle where the suspect was killed. Another officer was shot and transported to a Phoenix hospital for treatment. A memorial has been set up for Lopez in front of the White Mountain Apache Police Department. Lopez started with the department in January. His family flew in from California over the weekend and told ABC 15 they're grateful to the community for their support and plan to take Lopez back home to the LA area. Meanwhile, the Navajo Nation is providing law enforcement assistance. 10 Navajo police officers took the oath of office from a White Mountain Apache judge last week, which allows them to patrol and perform public safety duties on the Fort Apache Reservation while the tribe mourns the loss of Officer Lopez. The tribe is also receiving city, county, state, and federal support. The Cherokee Nation and the U.S. Mint are hosting a public event Monday to celebrate the release of the Wilma Mankiller Quarter. The quarter is one of five designs for the first coins in the American Women Quarters program. The four-year program highlights the accomplishments and contributions of trailblazing American women, including in areas of civil rights, government, humanities, science, space, and the arts. Mankiller was the first woman elected principal chief of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma and a well-known advocate for Native Americans and women's rights. The coin's design depicts Mankiller with a resolute glaze wrapped in a shawl and the seven pointed stars of the Cherokee Nation. The inscriptions on the coin in English are United States of America, Wilma Mankiller, and Principal Chief. The coin's inscription of the Cherokee Nation is in the Cherokee syllabary. The release of the Mankiller Quarter is the third coin in the program. The celebration is taking place in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. The U.S. Mint and the National Women's History Museum will hold a film screening and panel discussion on Mankiller in Washington, D.C. on Friday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The upfront cost of solar panels are something too high for small organizations. A bond program is helping nonprofits afford switching to solar. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many nonprofit organizations would like to install solar panels, but the upfront cost can be prohibitive for groups on tight budgets. So an organization in Wisconsin has created a financing model to help community groups go solar. Elise Couillard is with Legacy Solar Co-op. Through the group's Slice of Sun Solar Bonds program, co-op members can invest in 12-year bonds that help cover the cost of solar arrays at nonprofits and community groups. Bondholders earn interest while supporting a cause they believe in.
Our members are some of the fiercest supporters of solar.
In 2021, the program helped finance solar arrays at a chapter of the Humane Society, a Boys and Girls Club, an elementary school, a senior community, and several other organizations. She says the solar helps these groups lower their utility bills and direct more funds to their core missions.
Any money that they're not having to spend on their electrical bills can go towards a new staff member. It can go towards care for their residents. We know that these nonprofits and these community organizations are doing such amazing work, and we can help accelerate that amazing work by freeing up more funds for them to do so.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 6th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Abby Marr. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Tin Can Phone. At 11, we'll hear Times Like Now with host Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews curator Bruce Gunther about Turning Inward, Judy Chicago, a new show at the Oregon Jewish Museum. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to